Hello, and welcome to another episode of 10,000 Posts. It's your favorite show about how everything is posting. My name is Hussein. You can follow me at hkismani on twitter.com. As always, I am joined by my esteemed co-host, Phoebe Roy, who has just said to me that every drink should be mulled from now until February.
Yeah, and I stand by it. I mean, I did mean either wine or cider, but like, I'm willing to stand by this for other drinks as well. Mull your milk.
Mulled Coke Zero.
Yeah. Mulled Monster Energy.
Oh, shit. Okay, I'm not going to be able to think of anything else except for that at that point. Like, one of my favorite food posts ever has like been was the guy who made a blue Monster Energy mac and cheese. And he charted the whole process. It was either blue or it was green, but it definitely was like a Monster Energy.
Would you eat it? And,
yeah, I would. But I would only because I'm still kind of like, when we first started the show, one of my ambitions was to get sponsored by Monster Energy, and that is still very much my like how I see the show going.
Right.
I want the merchandise. I want the t-shirts. I want the Monster Energy hat that all the UFC guys wear.
That would be great.
Yeah. So if anyone from Monster Energy is listening to this, like, please, I've been wanting this for a very long time. And we are joined by a returning guest, Ed Anguezo. Ed, how's it going?
Pretty good. It's going good here. It's cold as hell.
Yeah.
But I guess that's just how it is for the next 4 months. Good. How about y'all?
Well, we're really glad that you joined us. That you've been able to find time to spend with us during Thanksgiving.
Thanks for having me on.
Both of us forgot that it was Thanksgiving this weekend. We had Shoshana on earlier today, who reminded us of that. So it's very nice that you guys are taking time out for us. For people who don't know who Ed is, you should listen to his podcast that he co-hosts with another friend of the show, Jason Sandowski, called This Machine Kills. Or you can read his columns at Vice. We'll be talking about some of them on this episode. Ed, as always, we asked whether there was a post or something that you wanted to talk about before we kind of go into like the whole meat and potatoes of the metaverse and like Facebook's next steps. And you had mentioned something that I kind of followed a little bit, but I wasn't really like I didn't follow completely, which was this thing called Constitution DAO, which wasn't really a post, but it was more of kind of like a NFT adjacent phenomenon. And I guess for like, you know, we spoke a little bit about NFTs, funny enough, with Shoshana, but ultimately got to the conclusion that like we have no idea what's going on. And I wondered whether you could explain to us like what the hell Constitution DAO is, and like why there was like such hype over it.
So a DAO is it's called a decentralized autonomous organization. And it's supposed to be this revolutionary way of decision making that's collective, but also corporate and individual, but collective. And what it basically is you get a bunch of people, or these DAOs have been operating in ways where it's like they're selling NFTs to raise funds to collectively decide to do something. And this DAO said, what if we sold a bunch of NFTs to raise money so we could buy a copy of the Constitution? By buying an NFT, you don't actually get a share in the ownership of it. You get a share in where it's like displayed, kind of. And very quickly that fell apart, largely because, I mean, they raised a lot of money. They raised like $40 million close to $40 million, but they were outbid by Ken Griffith, a lovely ghoul on Wall Street who was the center of a bunch of conspiracy theories about why GameStop trading, or stocks trading, was halted on Robinhood. But basically, he bought it out, and then they tried to refund it, and the refunds hit a wall because the fees for returning people's money, returning people's Ethereum, were so high that basically you've just lost all your money. And so it was just like a lovely, like, can't really figure out what the fuck we're going to do. Don't really have any clear guidelines on how we're going to democratize this copy of the Constitution, but we're not actually going to democratize it. And then also when we can't buy it, we promised refunds. We know we promised refunds, but we're not actually going to refund you the money because it's so expensive to give you back the money.
Right.
You got nothing.
Yeah.
Clusterfuck.
So when I was kind of like looking through the hashtags and stuff, or like just like the crypto kind of people that I follow, there was like people who were trying to justify it on the basis that like they saw the DAO more as like a cooperative. So, and I guess that kind of like hits back to what you were talking about, like in that early explanation about it's a way of like collective decision-making, but crucially it's one where like, if you are wealthier, if you have like more of a financial stake, then like you have more of a say.
It's explicitly that the more you can buy tokens, the more NFTs you can buy. So they're usually governed. Your votes are represented as through these governance tokens. And the more money, the more you put into this thing, the more tokens you get, and the more decision making power you have. So it is very explicitly like your dollars equals votes a lot of the time. Yeah. Or sometimes if you have like if you contribute a lot of labor, then you get an inordinate say over this stuff. But I think it's also interesting to note that it's not really decentralized or democratized. There is like a cadre of people who make and set the guidelines that people operate within. A lot of the decisions are made without input from people. It's a very narrow stream of decisions you're actually allowed to have input on, you know? So essentially a corporation, right?
Right. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I genuinely don't know like what. So one tweet that I had found, which I guess has been, I've just put it in like our Zencaster chat right now, is from, I guess it's like the official, I don't know if it's like an official Constitution DAO Twitter page, but like at least one with like nearly 50,000 followers, where it says, "We didn't get the Constitution, but we made history nonetheless. We broke records for the largest crowdfund for a physical object and most money crowdfunded in 72 hours, which will of course be refunded to everyone who participated, to all our 17,437 contributors. Thank you." And then they sort of like go on in their thread to kind of talk about like that, even though they didn't get the Constitution, the fact that like they kind of came close, or like the fact that they were able to like raise so much money is like more proof of like crypto and Web3. And like it kind of, the thing I get whenever I try to understand this particular area of Twitter is just how, as like, they love doing threads, but it just kind of gets more incomprehensible like as you read further down. So like at one point, this guy goes, or like the Constitution DAO account goes, "We memed this into reality, we made history, all of us." And this reminds me a lot of like, I mean, two moments where it's like memeing your way into history, one being the Trump election, the other being the GameStop like stuff, right? So I kind of wanted to ask like, how similar is this to what we saw with like GameStop, for example, where it's kind of like, it seemed to be much more about like critical mass and the idea that like the value, or at least kind of the effectiveness of the action is intrinsically linked to like getting people really hyped up about the action in and of itself.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of this comes down to you have a lot of money, and then the money tries to generate interest, and then a horde of people follow because they're seeing money in it and they want to make money. Mm-hmm. In this one, it's a little bit different in that, like, you have that sort of dynamic where a lot of money is being put forward and people are, and they're creating a certain narrative about how this is going to create the future. This is how this is the future of ownership. And like, wouldn't it be cool to have a piece of American history while we're making history? And so people pour money into it as a result of whatever narrative PR that these that the DAO has been able to construct. And then also a good chunk of people get into these DAOs because they actually aren't like, they don't understand how they work. A lot of people get into DAOs, you know, from what I've seen from the DAOs that I've been following, because they think they're going to make money somehow off this thing, as if,
right,
you know, putting money into the Constitution DAO might make money because maybe it'll be put in some place and you'll get a profit share of the museum or the exhibition or some shit, right? You know, similar thing with like City DAO, where ostensibly it's not a sort of investment. You're helping fundraise so that a city can be made. And in Wisconsin, they tried to buy a patch of land in Wisconsin in a pretty like arid area that doesn't get much rain. But there were some people who bought these NFTs thinking like there'd be some way to make money off of it, trading the NFT, for example. And the same with, you know, Kraus DAO, which wants to buy an NBA team. You know, all these DAOs have a significant amount of people who are large donors, and then a significant amount of people who are following because large donors are involved, and the narrative touches on something they genuinely do believe. They do believe the Constitution should have display of the Constitution should be democratic, you know, or they're really passionate about that for some reason. They do believe that, like, we should build a city on the blockchain, whatever that means. They do believe that an NBA team should be on the blockchain, you know, and so they get behind it And then there's a not insignificant group of people who are like, I want to make money. Oh, fuck. Like, how do I make money in this? I can't.
Yeah.
Because I don't have a lot of money.
What this reminds me of more than anything else is that I remember when I was a kid, there was always like one kid whose like dad insisted he had like a piece of the Berlin Wall that he was like, yeah, like, and this is going to be worth so much. And it was just like, it was just like a kind of brick. Segment of brick that he'd clearly like picked up from like outside his house. But he was like convinced that it was like, yeah, no, I bought this and it's a piece of the Berlin Wall and this is going to be worth money someday, kids. And like, and that's just what it makes me think of. The way they all talk as well is like mums on Facebook who are involved in pyramid selling.
Yeah.
It's such a particular kind of linguistic affect and cadence and it makes a mockery of the idea of like publicly owned objects and like publicly owned art, which I do actually happen to think is like sort of quite an important thing. I think art, like, I think in the main, the artistic sort of output of a culture should belong to the people, and it feels like playground shit.
Someone's
just like, oh, that guy over there has said that if we put our money in this, then we will be part of this thing. And he said it, and he seems like he knows what he's talking about. So this must be true. And it's not. It doesn't seem to be based on anything kind of foundational or material. And I'm just really interested in what you kind of what you think about like what, like, just sort of getting down to the nub of like, what is it? What does it mean? What is this?
I mean, it's speculation. A good chunk of it is like speculation. Season 4 of Ozarks. You know, a lot of fucking money laundering is going on here. I mean, and to be fair, like they're. A lot of people get into mixing NFTs and art because they do think that that the art system as it is right now is fucked, and that maybe the application of technology, you know, will disrupt it and shake it free of stodgy institutions, of the inability of certain artists to break through, of like an insular and, you know, highly networked sort of industry that relies on things that a lot of people don't have: money, capital, friends, in certain places, you know, like, the reality is that the people who pushed this stuff in the beginning were not pushing it to like revolutionize the art industry and the art space. They were pushing it because it made some fucking money, you know, and maybe a few of them were idiosyncratic individuals who are like, you know, actually this would be, you know, something that I would like to see implemented at large. But, you know, usually when stuff is pushed and driven by a few individuals, it's because they're going to make money from it, right? Mm-hmm. And the adoption of these technologies, of NFTs in particular, I think people have lost the plot and kind of believed in the narrative that the early adopters, the early, like, large, well-financed adopters advocated for, which is this will revolutionize art and allow unheard of digital artists to break free of like traditional ways of getting their art noticed, when in reality it's just being used to advance the worst elements of financialization and the worst elements of speculation. Yeah. Where now you have people like, it's not being used to cultivate, I guess, like new art movements. It's not really being used to cultivate access to art. It's really being used to like pass around JPEGs or to support marketplaces where these JPEGs and other art forms can be made, where the value is like incredibly inflated and not really representative of anything other than how well you can game what people think something is worth.
I don't know. I think some of the lazy apes look kind of cool.
Come on. Shut up. You don't think that. You're just being annoyed. Shut up.
I saw one that had like the Fred Durst backwards red hat and the goatee, and I was just like, that's fucking sick. And if I had money, I would try buy it.
You're planning a wedding, man. Like, come on.
I sent Riley posted a picture of like that newlywed couple with like the lion, the lazy, it's not lazy lion, it's like one of the other fucking like NFT lions, right? And I sent that to my fiance and I was just like, how would you feel if like we did our wedding photos like this? And she basically was just like, if you do this, I would just immediately divorce you. She's like so tired of my bullshit. And I'm just making it worse. But yeah, you're right. Like, I'm gonna blow my whole wedding fund on the Fred Durst lazy on the Fred Durst Bored Ape variant.
I mean, the truth is that there are basically very few people apart from artists who would benefit from a radical reimagining of the way that art works as like an item on the marketplace, like. And so of course, if someone pretends that they've come up with a way of doing it, you just have to ask, well, what's in it for you if you're not an artist yourself?
And even those who are, I mean, like, let's be honest, even the people, most of the times when someone is proposing a radical reimagination of something, it's not really a radical thing. It's more like, here's a way for me and my friends to make more money, right?
Yeah, let's clear away like some of the stuff. Yeah, it's very kind of like, okay, no, a new idea. Oh, okay, no, it's the same idea and yet somehow uglier.
Yeah.
One thing I sort of wanted to ask about like NFTs and I guess like crypto spaces more broadly. So when I was like looking through some of the replies to Constitution DAO just now, there seems to be like this real mixture of people who like are very clearly like wanting to make money, but also like people who genuinely do think that this is revolutionary technology, right? And for them, it's very much like owning part of the Constitution is a radical act of democracy that like crucially participation in a democratic process is not going to achieve, right? Or in some cases you have like, and you know, this came from just like a couple of podcasts I listened to within those types of spaces where they're talking about like building like autonomous, you know, zones and kind of building you know, a separate economy in which like crypto is exchanged and everything. And the idea being that like participation in crypto and NFTs are really a way of trying to imagine what a different kind of communicative experience or like, you know, different types of like political organizations are. I don't know whether I'm giving them too much credit, but I sort of wanted to know your thoughts on whether these types of things, even though lots of them are very evidently like Ponzi schemes and like basically like MLMs, whether they kind of elucidate a broader attempt to like imagine what alternative kinds of societies could be.
I think the most coherent and articulate crypto boosters insist that what they're envisioning is an alternative way of living and connecting with one another and relating with one another. Depending on your ideological leanings, it's either incredibly horrifying or like exciting, right? Is it exciting to commodify almost every single possible thing in our lives and have a clear quantifiable value for each transaction in each exchange? For me, that would give me a nightmare, you know, but yeah. For some people, that's exciting, right? There are a lot of people who think that capitalism has not gone far enough, or there are a lot of people who think that capitalism would work better if there were less, if there were even more inputs, right? And if we had an even better infrastructure for handling prices and handling information and inputting data to figure out what the ideal way to solve this or that problem would be, whether it's transit, whether it's logistics, whether it's food, whether it's access to the internet, right? Whether it's healthcare. But I don't know. I think that each time when I really listen to someone who's really enthusiastic about crypto or Web 3.0, whatever the hell that is, I've not really gotten a good explanation from anyone about it. But whenever I really try to sit down and talk with them and listen to it, what they're really describing is like, imagine a world where you had to pay for like everything. Every single thing, or had the capacity to pay for every single thing, wouldn't that be so much better? And it's like, yeah.
Wouldn't it be really cool if you could like add a kind of like numeric value to every literal exchange you do in like, you know, in a type of society? And like, in a lot of ways, that is kind of, and you know, we're going to talk about like metaverse and stuff in this episode. This sort of feels like what this iteration of metaverse at least is kind of heading towards, one where you can really like quantify and therefore like add a value to any type of like communication You know, so it's a type of like valuation structure that goes beyond just the idea of like exchanging a product.
Right. Sorry. And the belief that like, if we can do that, then things run smoother.
Right, exactly.
And if we can do that, then things are more efficient and productive, and there's better allocation of resources to who needs them, you know?
Yeah. And it was like where like hierarchy and stuff, like the absurd, like their like fixation among so many of them about like natural hierarchies and how like it's kind of, if you add this sort of corrective, which can be achieved through the blockchain. Again, like these are all just kind of like things that crucially they don't really substantiate on, or they do in ways that are just like largely incomprehensible. But I like my understanding of it is very much like, okay, they believe that the blockchain is basically going to be like an objective corrective to what they consider to like in the material world to be unfair hierarchies or like unfair types of social arrangements which benefit people, like because of, you know, in their words, like, you know, things like sexuality, race, like, you know, this is where the whole like affirmative action stuff comes in. Like they seem to kind of conceive blockchain as being a way of you know, correcting the kind of human miscalculations that they only attribute to like human ways of understanding things.
I love the idea of like looking at all of like taking a broad view of life and the world and all of its problems and being like, no, the issue here is it's too inexpensive. If we could find a way of making it more expensive, that would be good.
Yeah, you know, I think this reminds, I mean, a lot of this feels like a relitigation of some parts of the calculation problem of this debate about like how to centrally plan or not centrally plan the economy. And if like you could actually, if you could have enough information about markets, about prices, about economic transactions to make everything orderly so everyone gets what they need, and what system would do that best? Could socialists do it? Could capitalists do it? What methods could capitalists or socialists do it with? And the crypto proponents, the metaverse proponents, all these digitization proponents, they're really just advocating for like privatization of certain things and commodification of even more things, right? Commodification of social relations, commodification of like inanimate objects that aren't properly priced. Like one thing I remember, a nightmare that I wrote once about this initiative led by a former Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson Jr., I think, where their goal to stop climate change was to properly price nature. And if they did that, then they'd create financial instruments to disincentivize pollution and deforestation and figure out ideal fines. But really what it sounds like is doing is just creating like a derivatives market and an asset bubble for nature. And we know how good bubbles are every single fucking time we let Wall Street near them.
Yeah. The good thing about bubbles is that they are well known, like of all the shapes, to be the ones with the most integrity. Right. And nothing ever happens to bubbles.
Ever.
As soon as you're getting it into a sphere, then you've really got something cooking.
It's the most stable form in nature.
The most stable form in nature is the bubble.
If you let it grow really slowly, it gets really big before it breaks. And exactly. And if there's anything I've learned from my 2-year-old nephew, it's that seeing a really big bubble is probably one of the very few pleasures that of life that you remember. He loves his big bubbles so much. And like, yeah. So I think they've taken like the logic of a 2-year-old and like decided, how do we sort of like make a financial system out of this? I think
that's the best shape. Bubble.
Yeah, you can't blow a pyramid, can you? Yeah, so like again, I'm kind of just like looking through like more like DAO stuff right now, and like again, and I guess before we go on to like the kind of like main aspect of the show, like just as kind of like an offshoot question, Ed, as like someone who's sort of following the space a little bit more than we are, like one thing I've noticed is that like loads of crypto people are really love Twitter and they're kind of like obsessed with Twitter in a way that almost feels very disorientating. And I wonder whether part of it is that they kind of use Twitter as a way of at least inflating hype around kind of NFTs and other stuff like that. So there's a strategic reason to doing it. But at the same time, like it's really for like any kind of like journalist or anyone trying to kind of like even approach this stuff seriously, it's almost impenetrable. It's like, it's really hard to actually figure out what's going on, who the key players are, what they actually think is like valuable about it. It almost feels like encountering an online subculture that you have no prior experience with, and like you're suddenly like exposed by all these like, you know, the hashtags and terminologies and all these things, and you're now, and you're also being told that, yeah, this is like the future and you need to understand it, and you need to understand it in like very specific terms that benefit us.
Yeah, it's impenetrable unless you like join their Discords, their DMs, because that's also been helpful with each project I look at to sift through like what's their PR team is doing and what their PR team is hyping up, and like their internal discussions, right? And some of that is locked away and you have to like spend a lot of time getting in on to get further into it. And sometimes you don't, but a lot of the time, I mean, any serious project that is like really attempting to bring on people, either because it's a scam or because it believes its own hype, has some sort of PR team, has some sort of Twitter team. And I think that that is part of why Twitter is so oversized in its importance, but also because a lot of people use Twitter in a sort of low engagement way, I think, which makes it easier for them to just like consume constant PR that these projects put out and then join the more engaged communities, whether that's a DM or whether that's a Discord, whether that's a Slack. And it's easier to have these sort of like that feeling of community and also like actually getting involved in the project. I mean, it's once you get into these groups, it's pretty easy and they're pretty good about onboarding people to do like design or to do engineering or to do PR or to do planning or to do calls, right? In a way that is connected to Twitter, I guess, in terms of like building the hype, but can't really happen on Twitter.
Yeah. I guess like Twitter is like a way of at least like Twitter is a good way of like exposing people. Yeah. And I guess like Constitution Down and stuff is like a really good example of those like moments.
And where, memeing and shitposting. Right. Yeah, love that.
Yeah. Where people are sort of like exposed to what's going on, and they're kind of, because so many people are posting about it, it gives off this impression that like, oh, this is like really big or this is really important. And like Twitter is used as kind of like a myth making tool. And then as people kind of get further in, they're kind of given like treats that allow them to kind of participate. And when you're sort of given this participatory component, it means that you're much more likely to be like not only personally invested, but like you're much more likely to give up, you know, to like financially invest too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's important to remind ourselves at this point at the extent to which Twitter has become a point of coalescence rather than somewhere where people are as likely to post original content now.
Right,
it's a way to kind of like aggregate content from everywhere else. It's the central meeting point. And then there are obviously like there are big meme accounts on Instagram which exist to collect stuff from Twitter, and then it gets tweeted back, and it's all a kind of interesting ecosystem. But in order to have any kind of cut through, you do need to have that Twitter presence, even if the majority of people aren't on Twitter and aren't seeing it, but they're going to see its kind of offshoots elsewhere. So it's like everyone meet by the big clock.
Yeah, except when we met by the big clock, we would get like, you know, we would get like a treat of really bad weed in a really badly rolled spliff. Whereas now it's like, you don't even get like the weed. You just get,
you want a JPEG of the weed.
you get a JPEG of a late, of a bored ape smoking the weed.
Oh no.
That'd be a cool one. That might be a cool one for them.
Well, look, I think this is like a really interesting way to look at like what the future of these types of digital products are, and like crucially metaverse. Like, so we didn't do, like when the metaverse announcement was made about like a month ago, we didn't really like address it that much because we wanted to kind of like have a think about like, you know, what's been said and like actually speak to people who basically like know what they're talking about. But crucially, we also wanted to figure out what our own kind of thoughts were on like metaverse stuff. And one thing that like I know I've been thinking about is, in, especially in relation to crypto and like the development and valuation systems of these digital products, is that like metaverse seems like a way to kind of validate, like to validate them further. So we know that like Facebook has kind of experimented with like crypto projects in the past. I think they might still do, but I don't really know what's happened to like Libra recently. But it seems to me that like metaverse, the idea of like everything becoming like virtualized, and whether it exists, whether it kind of remains in a virtual like world or not, I'm not really sure. But like the impression that I get is very much like Facebook is trying to, like whatever like Facebook's next step is, it is very much trying to virtualize, digitize, and crucially like value every type of transaction, communication, or exchange that like you do, which crucially like operates in the in a very similar way to how people view crypto. So Ed, you've written like a bit about like metaverse and like, you know, the stuff around it. I was thinking about an article that you wrote, I think just before the announcement, which was called Facebook Can't Be Saved, which basically argued that like Facebook is too like big and too kind of like it spread too far for any type of regulation or even like breaking down to kind of like have that much of an effect, especially in relation to the harm that it's done. And I wondered whether like you could talk to us a little bit about that, about that in relation to like metaverse and where you think, or like how you think metaverse sort of came to be out of this moment.
Yeah, you know, there was a part of me that thought that metaverse was like this long-term sinister plan that they had to, but I think part of it is like bullshit. Good chunk of it was bullshit. Also watching the promotion video, a lot of it was describing technology that doesn't exist or probably never will. At least it never will in the way that they're envisioning. But what was there and resonating and is always present is this logic of commodifying and privatizing everything. This idea that, you know, you're not escaping the problems of the world, you're just entering a new one, which is worse than the world that you live in, lower resolution, you know, less fun, less sociable, less pleasing aesthetically, but more expensive.
Yeah.
And this will be like what will make you happy, you know, sitting on your bed on the floor in the corner of the room with no lights, but like an Oculus Rift that will make you dizzy after 30 minutes. That's happiness. Yeah. It's a really bizarre vision also, because I just, you know, Facebook insists that its mission, whatever, I think it's one of the mission statements it changed to over time is connecting the world. And I just don't understand how, I understand why from a capitalist perspective, this company thinks that they should just say this, but I don't understand why anyone should trust the company that has like facilitated genocides, that has like, you know, devastated large parts of the world through its connection, you know, poisoned the minds of tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people with an even more invasive form of connection, which is like you and a machine in another world or simulacrum of the world where you have to buy every single thing and where all the connections are mediated by that by that like narrow 3D space. I don't know, the metaverse is it just feels like a deeply like wrongheaded, and frankly, I get like evil in the sense that like if a company really cares about connecting the world, it would spend almost all of its resources on fixing the way that it fucked up the world. And it doesn't, because it can't and it won't. So this is just like a Hail Mary.
I mean, it to me, it sort of felt as if like whatever like metaverse like will be, the spirit of it is very much, or it seems to be, that like Facebook kind of knows, at least kind of, it may not admit that it's kind of the reason why so many like bad things have happened, but it's sort of known that this platform has been involved in a lot of really awful stuff that it can't fix, that in many cases is sort of, you know, it's gone out, it is like beyond its control. So what metaverse seems to be is almost like this way of trying to claw back, or at least try to like, they're positing on the basis of like, we're going to rebuild the internet, but crucially to do so to fix a lot of the problems that we are like we have caused. And the solution to that is to kind of like add even more like restrictions and like add even more limitations to how people communicate. And like that also extends to like modes of exchange as well, where, you know, one, like the way that like metaverse will commercially work is one where like you kind of have digital products or like types of digital currency that like function within Facebook space. Like, so what it seems to be is this way of like Facebook trying to seize more control on the basis that like this is the only way to fix the problems that we have caused.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think that it just it betrays the corrosive paucity of imagination in that's been kind of endemic to sort of tech culture in Silicon Valley in general, that when they sort of take this kind of line of like, well, we ask for forgiveness, not permission, you know, break stuff, fix it later. That's like, that's the only way to make changes. That's the only way to innovate. That's the only way to disrupt. And it sort of never occurred to anyone at any point during this, that this does not simply mean we can roll out a social media product that has a lot of bugs and then like sort it out later, that there are things that happen as a result of these as a result of these companies or any mediated by these companies which cannot be fixed later. So if they are sort of responsible for kind of providing a platform for somebody who later goes on to kill a bunch of people, like that's not buggy code. But because they've had, because of the, like I said, the paucity of imagination, all they can envisage that they might have to apologize for is something like a poorly performing digital product. Like they can't imagine any material real world consequences of their actions and behavior. All they can think of to do is like how to rearrange their like games room at the office.
this is one of the things I hate the most about capitalist technological development, because there's always, like you said, like you put it perfectly, there's really no real concern with material consequences beyond profit and how some ancillary effects on people might affect future profit opportunities, right? Yeah. There's this incentive to constantly push and always develop, even when there's nothing really to develop, or even when there's nothing to optimize, to always squeeze out more efficiency in these things. When honestly, I think we would have benefited from an attitude with social media and with a lot of these technologies of rolling them out much slower than they were, and also asking whether, like, it is an open question to me whether or not we should have like global communications platforms, which is not to say like whether or not you should be able to talk to people in other parts of the world, but whether you should do that on one fucking company's platform, and if that makes sense. And we have not really seriously entertained that. We've just kind of let the market decide, and by the market, it's really just been like we've let a company emerge in the space, and then it's developed so much of the infrastructure for other companies to come afterwards that's dictated on its own terms and on its own logic. And then they have the capital that they throw around at anyone who might compete with them anyways. And then they've also deployed a really effective army of lobbyists. They've also, they also benefit from the fact that all these people all come from the same class, or, you know, are educated in the same institutions, have the same sort of ideological leanings, where they don't see a problem with this, like, parasite that has grown and spans the globe. But it really is a parasite. Like, if we're really concerned about connecting people, and if we see that there's something that is connecting people and it's doing so in a toxic way, why are we not stopping, examining, rolling back? Because you can't do that in capitalist technological development. You can only go forward, and the only fixes can be more shit on top of the broken shit and the rotting edifice.
Because the foundation's not there. There's no healthy foundation to it. And without a healthy foundation, everything subsequent you build on top of it is just on a haunted burial ground.
Yeah. Also, crucially, as we spoke about / will speak to, we recorded two episodes today, so Ed, we have no idea what
we're
recording.
We're deciding which order to release them in.
So either we are about to talk to someone.
So welcome to episode one or two.
Well, welcome to 10K Post as Tenor. Right, no. So one thing we have spoken about is like how difficult it is to like sort of imagine what like different versions of the internet or like a kind of post-platform internet will look like. And how like this also like it reflects like a paucity of imagination, but it also reflects like this real inability to kind of actually figure out what a like if we understand that like the internet can be a good thing and like interconnectivity can be a good thing like for most people in the world, how can that be done in a way where, you know, that where that is equitable, or like that is kind of like even functional, right? I think there's a real challenge in figuring out what like a post-platform internet looks like. And like, even as I've like spoken to tech people and spoken to like people who like think about this as part of like their jobs, it's like, just, this is a confrontation that even they don't really have an answer to. And I sort of wonder whether the like platformization has like just really seeped out like all the imagination that we used to have, I think, like, you know, or like that used to definitely be there about what like an internet is, like what it could look like, but also what it's supposed to be for.
You know, that's also an open question. I don't think really, I think another thing that happens in capitalist development of tech is that there's not a real actual question and discussion about what the point of technology should be in our lives.
Yeah, exactly.
There's the assumption that just more of it is a virtue in of itself,
yeah,
and that it makes life easier and smoother and allows us to consume more things and introduces more convenience.
Right.
More often than not, if we really want, like if we were really actually thinking about how to use tech and how to deploy it in ways that make people's lives easier, we'd realize that sometimes the best technical solution is not using technology.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If you just have like, you know, a transportation problem in your town, right? Or in your neighborhood, you know, and 100 people or 200 people need to get somewhere, you can either try to organize, a taxi dispatch app and call it a ride share like Uber and Lyft did, or you could introduce buses and more public transit and e-bikes and all these other alternatives. And
have you heard of this thing called a tunnel?
Right. You know, or you could give $200 million to the Boring Company, as I'm sure some city will. Yeah. You know, a lot of the times technology is just buzzword used to justify privatization, much in the way that digitization is often a buzzword used to obscure privatization. It's just really a company saying, what if we did this ourselves in a way that allowed us to get no contest contracts, to get more money and from the government to crush our competitors.
Right. And it's like, and it's remarkable how like platforms are even very overt about this. So like, even when the announcement of like Metaverse happened, Mark Zuckerberg's whole thing was like, this is like a new level of like connectivity. So we're like connecting people and like, we're just sort of expanding our remit as a platform, which like to me presents this idea of a platform being like the, at least like this kind of conception of what a platform is. It's like sole function is to really just like make it more efficient to consume, like, you know, consume products, right? And to do it in like as fast a way as possible and as a seamless a way as possible, and a way to kind of like keep engulfing people into consuming products and services that you know, they're kind of like coerced into on the basis that like the like material alternatives like deteriorate anyway. And yeah, you're completely, I mean, all I will say that you're completely right. Like, you know, it's also how the kind of dominance of platforms and like platform capitalism more broadly has also kind of really reduced our expectations, let alone our imaginations of like what technology should be and what it should be there to do.
Mm. I think what is interesting is how rarely persuasive examples of the benefit to humanity of technology get brought up by tech people. So the example that I'm thinking of is advances in medical technology. So like nanorobotics and like the incredible advances in prosthetics and that kind of thing. But they don't talk about that. And it's so convincing and it's so persuasive. Instead, they're showing us the robot police dogs, and they're showing us like a sort of new way of living your life, which creates this artificial underclass who like the convenience of middle class people's shoulders are resting on, things that didn't exist 5 to 10 years ago, but now apparently are utterly essential and endemic to a middle class life in the global north. And that is what And that's what's brought up. It's like, oh, you didn't used to be able to get a takeaway from any restaurant you wanted. Like, why not? Like, why not say, like, now, if you have a heart condition, we can send a little robot to do it, and it's good. Like, what? Like, why not? Why not? Why not focus on something with like a kind of with an obvious, actual, tangible benefit? It's bizarre to me.
This is a really good point you raise, especially with the prosthetics. We just had an episode with someone, a disability scholar, or Britt Young. I believe her name is, and she was, we talked about how, okay, like prosthetics in general in the popular imagination are linked almost exclusively to military operations or to like super enhancement of individuals like bionic superheroes and so on. And the reality is that for a long time now, there have been more people born without a limb or in need of a prosthetic than have lost a limb or need a prosthetic because of an injury through war, through accidents, or and so largely it's been like, you know, born with something that requires it, or you have you develop a condition later in life like diabetes that requires the amputation of a limb. And instead of focusing on those people, both the popular imagination and the funding and the development of prosthetics is largely along the lines of military and hobbyist desires and needs. And so they're made way too expensive for these people who need them, for the Black and brown and indigenous people who are more often, who have high rates of diabetes and heart conditions that require them to get a prosthetic, than the few thousand soldiers in the 20 years beyond of the various invasions and secret ops across the global south of the war on terror have lost limbs or have needed them themselves. And that, I think, is in of itself a signal of how tech development and capitalism works, where it's like there's a very clear need among the population. There's a very clear need. There's a very clear way to do it and to provide it for everyone. And instead, we do the exact opposite, where we make it as expensive as possible for the people who need it. Whereas if you're a soldier or a hobbyist usually has enough money to cover it themselves. And a soldier is usually part of a program by their state that subsidizes it completely. And then the state also has pretty lucrative contracts with these firms to provide them with monopolies, duopolies, or massive lucrative contracts to advance more military tech. If we were really sitting down and thinking about what tech do we need, what tech do we want, and what do, or actually to reverse, if we're thinking about what do people need and is there a technical fix for that, then we would be focusing and reorienting the entire political economy around what people need when they're born without limbs, when they lose them from injuries in their workplaces, or when they have health conditions that require the limbs, and figuring out, okay, how do we address those issues systemically? And then how do we also develop the technology for when people still need them? And instead, it's ass backwards. And it's just, we have this technology, we have this capital. Let's just hand it over to some group and then enrich them and allow them to get richer and richer and allow their needs to be met and allow them to dictate the terms of how it develops. And that's how it is in almost every sphere of life, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
One thing,
I have absolutely nothing to add. That's
Cool. as usual, Ed's analysis is always right. End of show notes. One thing I wanted to ask about. So I found an article that you had written about the Chan Zuckerberg initiative and like their sort of like weird relationship just before like Meta launched, but why, like where, like it seemed as if it was initially about like a domain or like at least kind of like getting an app or whatever. It seems to also indicate like Zuckerberg's influence in this project, right? And like I think one of the stories that sort of came out, especially like in relation to the Facebook papers and stuff, is how hands-on Zuckerberg still like intends and like still in like wants to be, which seems to be something that is uncommon among like tech people like him. Like I guess there's always that question about like why has he just like not retired, or why has he not taken like a backseat role and stuff. So I kind of wanted to ask you about like where you think Mark Zuckerberg and just like those types of like tech characters, where they sort of fit within like this next iteration of Facebook like slash Meta, and why, yeah, and I guess like how like Zuckerberg's direct influence will affect, might affect like the next stages of Facebook.
Yeah, you know, I think for Zuckerberg in particular is like pretty young among all the tech founders and CEOs. He's like 37, 38. So part of me also feels like this man is one of the most powerful people who's ever lived on the planet. And he has no interest in giving up that power, right? Most of these people, regardless of their age, are pretty powerful, and you have to wrest it away from them. And we usually, we don't, I'm sure, you know, there's all sorts of internal political plays and power plays that we don't see on the inside, but it is usually a long time before these people even consider stepping down. And this guy who is 37 and who is trying to personally associate the next stage of the company with himself seems to have no interest in stepping down anytime soon, whether it's because of the way that the shares are still structured and he still has majority control over the power or non, like a plurality of voting power, you know, over the company, whether it's the way that he structures, you know, the delegation of authority and duties there, where, you know, he still has central say and veto power and is personally involved in these decisions. It's Zuck. It's still very much Zuck's company. And I don't think, unless the company's gotten rid of, that's not going to change. But I also do think that this is, you know, a thread we see with all these tech founders, because at the end of the day, you know, a lot, Silicon Valley is infused with this sort of Randian individualist, like I am the superhero. I am steering this ship on the right course. Mindset among all these founders. All of these founders really believe that they either really believe that they're making something that will change human history, or that is genuinely novel and is going to improve the lives of a lot of people and make investors money, right? And that is also another vector in capitalist tech development, which is dangerous. You know, if we should not be having like idiosyncratic, incredibly rich, wildly disconnected people deciding what the new technologies are going to be, what the direction of huge sums of capital are going to be, and where they're going to go and be placed, how tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of workers' lives are going to be affected by their whimsical decisions or by their attempts to optimize or expand profit margins or cut costs, right? These are, like the political economy of technology is really just like a huge industrial fiefdom, you know? It's like a lot of lords, a lot of like incredibly wealthy individuals who have complete control over these absolutist companies and dictate the terms in which technology gets developed in their domain and also in other domains as to the extent that they can, and then have really personal relationships or personable relationships with centers of power in the government, right? Or in the legislature and the judiciary that end up arriving at conclusions and opinions that coalesce with their own. You know, it's just, I think it's like all the elements of the way that technology is developed in our world are the worst possible ones. If you were designing the worst possible way to develop technology and make it work for as many people as possible, this would most likely be the one you choose, where it's just a bunch of people who think they're Ubermensch with a lot of money, deciding the terms on which everything gets developed. And it's usually terms so them and their friends get rich, and then people who look like them and live like them have slightly better lives at the expense of billions of people who are invisible and out of sight and out of mind.
I guess like one question. Sorry, Phoebe, were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to it's just a sort of observation that I was thinking of as we were talking, that it is of a kind of superior villainy that, and this is specifically about going back to like social media companies as like posting platforms, as posting host platforms, that it's like, it's so brilliant. And I don't think it was planned. Like I'm not as black-pilled as that, but it was certainly made use of and taken advantage of that they've managed to introduce a way of communicating and a way of forming your opinions and a way of learning that everything can be memed and everything can be turned into a talking point, including the completely correct criticisms of the way that they operate. So like now, like so say something like with NFTs, like everybody knows the talking point of minting one NFT like burns 100 square feet of Amazonian rainforest. But because it's been memed by the very platform that it gets posted on, it no longer has any power. It no longer has any power to persuade. It no longer has any power to access the actual centers of power. It's just a thing that you can say to show which side of the debate that you're on. It's sloganeering. And it is also sloganeering that because of the decay of like the power of posts, you also can't keep saying the same thing again and again and again repeatedly, even if it carries on being correct. So someone's going to have to come up with a kind of a novel way of saying NFTs are really catastrophic for the environment. Facebook should be broken up. It's really bad that Amazon get government contracts and can act as infrastructure, because there's a half-life to the post. So you can't use these platforms to change anything, because it's inbuilt that everything gets memed and everything gets sloganeered.
It just ends up, everything becomes a spectacle, you know?
Yeah. I feel like someone could have come up with something about the master's tools, but I don't know. That sounds, like, I'm just spitballing. That sounds fake. No, forget that. That doesn't work.
But I think this is like a really interesting point, because it's very much like, I've been thinking about this a bit, about like the language that we use to try like describe like how we exist online, and crucially like how we sort of develop a language that kind of presents at least ideas of like what a different type of life on the internet can be. And like how difficult that is when you're sort of like the platforms that you use to try articulate that are all exist within like this particular nexus, where, you know, ultimately like this podcast will be like promoted on Twitter, and it'll be like, I don't think we don't promote on Facebook, but like maybe like we like would have at some point, but like, you know, you might send it to someone on WhatsApp, but event like at some point, like you will kind of encounter the network that you're trying to criticize, and it kind of like falls. And then even just like by broader extension, like the fact that the way that we do this show is through like subscribers, and it's through like, you know, these kind of this like piecemeal support and a type of infrastructure which you know, in which you basically have to kind of produce and promote content in order to kind of being able to in order to kind of continue doing that. So it's like there's a real problem of like articulation and how that kind of plays out in practice. But then conversely, when you look at like the people who are maybe like not excited about the metaverse, but at least kind of like recognize that some form of it will be like inevitable, and that they kind of want to be ahead on that. So I'm thinking now about like, you know, crypto NFT people, for whom like they kind of recognize, and or like Ed, I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on this actually, about whether these guys like recognize that they will have to kind of partake in some sort of like metaverse infrastructure. So them kind of like putting all in on these like types of digital products is really just kind of testament to a much broader belief that eventually Facebook will kind of provide an infrastructure that like attributes more value to these digital products than like currently exists right now. And therefore for them, like they are much more likely to at least be on board with these types of like developments, despite how obviously dystopian and like quite frankly ridiculous they are.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think there's a few groups of like far-seeing people. There are some groups of people who believe that the projects they do are going to build up the infrastructure. They really believe that their project is going to do it, and so they're trying to get in and cultivate people to follow them so that theirs is more valuable, and so that whatever world they want is real. And yeah, I think there are all definitely some people who think that, you know, if you build it, or if you try to build it, then Facebook will come. And, you know, Facebook will throw in some of the billions of dollars that it's investing in building this shit, or says that it's investing in building this shit. And that other companies, because Facebook is doing it, will throw in billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars. And so very much like if we can try to, maybe we can make some money now, and then maybe we can build something now, and then it will be a lodestar or like a part of the foundation in the future. Or just by virtue of these other companies saying they're interested in it, it'll be something that people try to build around or replicate. You know, yeah. I think there are definitely some people who because they really believe that this is the future. That's the way to go. And then there are other people who like see that that's where the hype is going. And they're like, I'm just going to scam some people. I'm just going to make some money off of this.
Yeah.
It is hard often. And I think that's really like a key element of the crypto space to tell which is which. You know, there's a lot of talk about how all of this is trust and this is building new ways of trusting individuals and new ways of ensuring that assets, underlying assets are secure and that you are engaged in a transaction with someone who's not going to rip you off. But for something like that, there's a lot of fucking scams in this space. And part of that is because there's still a lot of undefined and ambiguous and propagandized bullshit floating around, right? A lot of people believe something works the way it doesn't work. A lot of people believe in lofty narratives or susceptible to lofty narratives because a lot of it is still running on fumes. A lot of it is not built. A lot of it is not real. A lot of it is just vibes and the desire to build something later, right? A lot of the projects I've covered right now are one reason why I focus a lot on projects in their early stages is one, because they are in their early stages and that's when a lot of them are like cutting away certain ideas, making huge changes and compromises, but also because a lot of them just are, you know, like a lot of these things don't exist, won't exist. And it's interesting to see whether or not they know that they won't exist or feel that they won't exist and think that they're building it for someone else to come, or whether they're just going to be a scam. Like a lot of the most interesting crypto projects are the ones that just launch off the ground, because that's, you know, when you get to test various ideas and theories about whether this is real or that's fake and who wants what in this group. And I think that as more money gets poured into the metaverse space, you're just going to see a sort of consolidation around a few standard things and a few boring implementations that are wildly divergent from the high-flying rhetoric and nonsense that was being pitched this year, last year, and will be pitched for probably the next 2-3 years about how this is going to revolutionize the internet, how this is going to revolutionize human society, how this is going to revolutionize the way you talk to your friends and spend time with your friends and have friends. You know, all these things are not actually going to manifest. It's just going to really be another way to spend money. Oh, are y'all there?
Oh, hello.
Did I cut off?
You froze. So the last thing you said was,
Did you finish your point in the local?
Yeah.
Okay, because we were going to wrap up anyway. So I can just be like, that's a great point, Ed. I'm conscious that like we all have to go and like it's Thanksgiving and you should be able to like have
that. That would have been a really good time if you'd like felt like just unleashing a bunch of slurs. That would have been a great time to do it.
You guys are going to learn something about me today.
They've just got a voice clip of Hussein being like, yeah, good point. I agree with all of that.
I agree, especially, yeah, okay, I'll finish on that. All right, so we're back in 3, 2, 1. Yeah, I completely agree with you, with Ed. Everything that you said. Just for the record, for like listeners, Ed, like Ed cut off like just as he was ending his point. So I have no idea what he said in the uncut tape, but like maybe maybe like Devin can put that in his slurs folder.
That's not funny, Devin.
When
a lot of new ones. I've been learning a lot from the Americans.
so if Devin ever feels like suing us for whatever reason, like, you know, they've got a lot of material.
And here's the danger.
We should wrap up because we've covered a lot. And like, I think that we could talk about NFTs and crypto and like crypto scams and just like all this stuff for ages, not least because I feel like we still haven't really uncovered what exactly is going on, but we'll collectively figure it out. Like, So Ed, thank you for all the work that you do in attempting to like pursue this. If people want to read some of that work or listen to the stuff that you're doing, how can they do that?
I'm on Twitter, Big Black Jacobin. I'm at Vice, you know, with my name, Edward Anguissa Jr. I have a website I've not updated, but it's just my name. And podcast, This Machine Kills, where I talk with Jathan Sadowski and Jeremy Start about all things related to tech and the reason why our tech looks the way that it does.
It's a great show and you should listen to it. We'll put all the links in the show notes. As always, you can follow us at 10kpostpod on twitter.com. You can follow me at H Kizvani. You should also listen to the other stuff that I do, Trash Feature, Human Error on BBC Sounds. I do that show with Olga Koch. A couple of other things that are coming out soon. My newsletter, like, that's new. Like, that's in my Twitter bio. Subscribe to it. Like, yeah. Phoebe, if people want to, like, follow the stuff that you do, how can they do that?
If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can at PRHRoy. If you want to see visual proof of me using the master's tools to dismantle his house, you can do that over on Instagram at Phoebe_Rosa_Holly. And if you would like to hear me and friend of the show Milo Edwards talk about Seinfeld, you can at Masters of Pod.
Great. This show is produced by Devon. You can follow them at Devon_on_earth. You can also listen to their podcast, which is called Kill James Bond. Also another really great show. Lots of great shows around. I think that's it from us. So until next time, catch us later. Have a good one. Bye.